Listen, everyone makes messes. It's just a part of life. And the bigger you live, the bigger the mess, if you know what I mean. That's why you need Fabuloso. With twice the active cleaning ingredients, it just completely takes the drama out of any mess. It smells great while you clean. The only way to describe it is the scent of passion. And once you're done cleaning, it lasts so long. You know, if you make a mess, you can get your home dramatically clean with Fabuloso. No worries.
Look at the screen. William Blix, the great red dragon, and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself.
Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mindhunter, a podcast about Michael Mann's 1986 full sicko mode adaptation of Thomas Harris's terrific page-turner Red Dragon. The movie is Mindhunter. The podcast is Mindhunter. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Today, I am joined by great friend of the show, a true legend of physical media, a person who makes me insanely jealous of their drip. Not only photographs of drip that arrives at their house, but drip that they are wearing for this very podcast. It's the managing editor of Letterboxd. You've seen them around or you've heard them on great shows like the B-Side podcast and a whole bunch of other places. Mitch Beaupre. Mitch, welcome back.
What's up, buddy? Thanks for having me. Had to throw on the Heat shirt. You know, I was figuring out what to wear and I thought, you know what? Blake Howard, that guy, he's so sly, but so am I.
So am I. Oh, I have something to show you as well. I have something to show you. I'm just going to just say it like on this. People may have seen it on socials by the time they are hearing this episode. I'm going to just very quickly hold something up for you.
Oh, shit. Live reveal. Oh, shit. Okay. All right. Thanks so much. A personal note from the man himself.
A personal note from the man himself. And something. I'm going to show Mitch. I'm going to give him give them a live reaction. Here we go.
Here we go. Oh, fuck yes. Heat Film Crew 1995 official. What is that, a shirt or a sweatshirt? What are we looking at here? T-shirt?
It's a shirt. It's a t-shirt.
Yeah, there it is. I look like a chump now with what I'm wearing. My drip is no comparison to the drip over there.
I have decided that by the time people are hearing this, Mitch was right. The great Michael Mann has graced me with one of the greatest gifts that any person who is a fan of Michael Mann or Heat, I consider myself maybe the biggest fan of one of or both of those things, a Heat 1995 Film Crew t-shirt, which I do have to wear, I think, Mitch, once. Just to take a photo.
You don't want to mess that up. You got to frame that thing.
And then immediately frame it. That's exactly we are speaking the same language. It'll have to do that.
What if you wear it and like your kids spill some spaghetti sauce on it? Like it's just you can't.
No.
It's
temperature controlled safe stuff. That's where
Ethan Hunt would have to break in from the ceiling to get this baby out of here.
It is the most prized possession, and so it's very, very cool. It is great seeing you. Thank you so much for being a part of Mindhunter. Wouldn't have wished to do this show without you coming along and having some fun. Can you tell the listeners, because I know a little bit about it, because obviously we communicate a lot, whether we're talking about, not just on podcasts about Michael Mann, but all places. Can you tell the folks listening your relationship, particularly with Manhunter?
Yeah, totally. Manhunter, I can't remember where it came exactly in my man journey. I know that Collateral was my first. Collateral came out when I was like 15 in theaters, and I saw it and was like so many people, like I had never seen anything like it. The digital photography, especially, I was like, what even is this? And so that kind of led me into diving into more of his stuff. I probably saw like Heat and The Insider like first, and then
bang bang straight away. Yeah.
Then I came around to Manhunter. I remember I bought the DVD of it, which had like a pretty tight cover, and I'm sure I had seen Silence of the Lambs before it, but I think when I saw it, I was probably like 16, and I honestly think I wasn't ready for it. Like I liked it. I liked what it was doing, but I think I went into it more just like, oh, this is like a serial killer movie, and kind of taking it from there. And I didn't end up like it. So for me, it kind of wasn't one of those mans that I like revisited a lot, like those other three that I mentioned. Mm. And like Miami Vice, I was like going back to it over and over again. And Manhunter, I didn't see again until like almost like 20 years later, almost. So last year I interviewed Michael Mann for Ferrari, and like,
right.
Leading up to that, I rewatched like all of his movies just to get in the headspace. Like you're going to speak to the guy, you got to
cover the mindset
on his level. Yeah, exactly. And Manhunter for me was like, what, out of that kind of rewatch journey, like Mohicans and Manhunter were the two that I most was like, oh, I didn't realize before like the game that these movies had.
Yeah.
And I almost was surprised because I hadn't seen Manhunter in so long, like how much, not like the bones of the story, like I had seen Red Dragon, I'd seen Hannibal, so like the bones of the story I kind of know, you know, that's just like in the DNA at this point, but like
it's in the pop culture lexicon now as well.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Exactly, like the do you see, you know, like all that kind of stuff, like you kind of know that. But what really struck me was how much like specific images in Manhunter had, like, without me even consciously being aware of them, like had stuck with me all of these years. Like Graham with his, you know, his hand up against the glass, like right before it's, you know, just you and me now, sport, which like Peterson delivering that line is like the cool, like that is like the most like dudes rock shit, like in cinema history. But like even more so than that, like Joan Allen, like stroking the tiger, you know, which is not a euphemism, but like her, that whole scene, like that, the texture of that, the
thank
beauty
God
of
Dan
that.
Mecca wasn't doing that scene. Yeah, we would never finish the episode. He'd still be going.
But like kind of that idea of like taming the danger of that, like that mixture of danger and beauty in that scene. Like that's something that kind of like reverberated within me without me even recognizing it for so long. And you know, speaking of Dan and Connor, like they're Connor, I think in your episode with them earlier on in this, mentioned about how like Manhunter for him, he feels like really codified, like a lot of what Mann would represent for the rest of his career. And I feel like that's the kind of thing that I couldn't key into when I first saw it. You know, I just wasn't versed enough in film in general to really like pick up on that. And rewatching it now after seeing so many Mann movies, it's like, oh, this is like so much the essence of like who he is, like aesthetically, but also like thematically. It makes total sense why, even though this is an adaptation of a book, like this is something that he would completely sink in with. And I think really elevate what's there. I mean, it's already great on the page, but like elevate what's there and like kind of fuse it with the things that he was bringing to it as well.
Yeah, I think now you touched on something. So a consideration that is so essential to, I think, what this series is, which is when you have so many other comparisons of adapting that same material, when you strip away the kind of essential components of that, it's just what's left is all that the filmmaker personally brings to why it's different. And so for me, coming back to Manhunter in this series, that's all I'm seeing. I just see him so clearly because I'm a huge Hannibal fan. I really love the Thomas Harris book. I really love Silence of the Lambs. I even have the softest spot for the wacko, Hannibal Ridley Scott, just Ridley like killing it.
A weird movie.
It's a weird movie. It's full Universal movie monster Hannibal. Really, really a fan of that. I detest Red Dragon for many reasons. But I like you. I think this was one that I glanced at, saw, probably saw again, really thoroughly enjoyed. It did not immediately, what didn't like sort of fuse itself to me in ways that his other films did. But Mohicans was a foundational text for me. So I always knew around that time, I'm like, you can't just make The Last of the Mohicans and not have game. You know, I was just like, I was always like, I want to look back and you can start to see emerging that voice. Cause for me, the clarity of his voice in Mohicans is so amazing. Everything, texture, production, the level of difficulty, all those things, big actors. So yeah, that's another adaptation from him, adaptation rather. And so, yeah, it's really interesting to hear you say that. And it's just been super fun going back and going, oh, I didn't recognize this, how deep Manhunter goes. And the other point I think you make is, there are just so many shots of Manhunter that are tattooed on my brain. They're like in my retina. You know, when I close my eyes, you know, that sometimes thing of like, you know, those old crappy plasma TVs, you know, if you played a game on them and
it would bleed
onto the plasma. It's like the shots in Manhunter are bled into the plasma of my eyelids. You know, the shots are incredible. Every scene is amazing. We are now at the 12th scene. So as people are listening, there are more episodes than scenes because I'm greedy. And sometimes when multiple people say they want to do a scene, I just say yes, because we've had so many wonderful guests, including Mitch. So we're now at the 12th scene, which is 44 minutes and 2 seconds to 49 minutes and 3 seconds of the theatrical cut. The director's cut that's on the disc is good. I don't know if it's better because I just the quality of the director's cut on the disc is not as, it doesn't look as crisp. It doesn't look as clear because they've had to cut in, you know, previous scenes that haven't had the benefit of upscaling. We've both heard on another coast to you, on the other side of the world to me, about a 70mm director's cut that is religious in nature. I'm very excited to one day hopefully get to see that. But if you don't know the minutes, which you shouldn't because you're not a psycho like I am, we are in the personal ad discussion, and the books in Lecter's cell is where we are at this moment. And sort of we've done the walk and talk. Something has been found in the cell. And now this is the real fantastic scene, a deliberation over what to do now that we know that Lecter and the Tooth Fairy or the Red Dragon are communicating with one another. So Mitch and I are going to pour over it. Mitch knows how to play this game, to interrupt, to tackle it, to pull it apart. And we're going to come back and talk about this great scene together in just a moment.
We believe the Tooth Fairy told Lecter to reply to him through the personal ad section of the National Tattler. The Chicago office is down there right now running through their ads.
Can I just say,
mustache.
I was just going to say, Dennis Serena holding a pencil and pointing at people in a room is cinema to me. Yeah. I don't want to watch any
behind him. Come on.
Multiple cacti, a mustache that you could set your watch to, pointing a pencil, this, that. Fantastic.
It's man, just like he has such an eye for faces too. Like he would just like, you know, people like Farina like wasn't even an actor. Like he's just like pulling people who like off the street who are like, oh, this dude, like this cop that I saw once, you know, I think has like a face for the big screen. Let's throw him on there and make him an indelible actor.
Has one of the best faces all time. Like Robert Prosky, famous stage actor, comes into Thief and becomes a staple of movies until his passing. You know, Farina just playing a random heavy in that movie and like, oh no, that's the guy I'm going to build entire TV series around. Like Crime Stories, it's a whole show that he's the anchor point in the whole show. It's crazy. And just to see, and I wonder if you see this, Mitchell, as well, how someone can have a level, like he's lived his entire life as a police officer. Obviously he's, you know, this procedural stuff is like Dr. Water stuff for him, you know, because all these other people are playing pretend and these are conversations he's either observed or done himself on different scales in his life. But the scale of his ability to understand cinematic performance from literally nothing, less than, you know, it's like 6 years ago or 5 years ago by the time the film is made from here. But that time difference between then and now in here is just insane to me. It's just insane how you can have that skill set so quickly. It's really impressive.
Yeah.
Because he's only doing a couple of things and they're with him. You know,
that's what's so interesting when I like think about like my favorite Farina, like he's like a guy that you would think like would be in a million things and just like chewed up. Like I could see Farina being a goddamn Eric Roberts and being in like a million movies a year, but he really was just like, the ones that pop the most are because a man knows how to utilize him. And like, man's one of those guys who he'll like, I think about West Studi a lot when I think about man and like Mohicans, and he like, man just like knows how to like pull these guys that, you know, so many other directors take advantage of. John Ortiz in Miami Vice is a great example. Like so many other directors like just don't understand even like what they have, like the potential that they have there, like this gift that is right in front of them that they can utilize. But Michael Mann knows those gifts and he puts them there and he activates them.
Yeah, completely.
We have cut into a line of communication between the Tooth Fairy and Lecter. If we find Lecter's reply, we plan to pull it, substitute it with one of our own. And this is what the Tooth Fairy will read, Bill.
Dear avid fan, inherit my mantle and surpass my achievements. Mementos for you at Baltimore Central, left luggage. Ticket number 72683.
It's a Secret Service letter drop. We plan to stake it out when he shows we'll grab anything from Chicago.
Not yet.
When do they go to press?
35 minutes.
Christ. Let's get to the physical.
There was no print.
Scale counts and core size of the hair match the blonde hair found in the Jacobies. That note was written by you.
Man's just like so smart at like pull it like man, when it comes to like process shit, right? Like I always think of Thief, like is like one of the biggest ones that comes to mind for me with man, but like he just knows how to like operate process like in movies. Like this is like exposition, but it's like mostly exposition, but like the way to that, it's like editing, the cutting back and forth, there's like this bounce like rhythm, but it's also not like so like superficial, like Aaron Sorkin kind of can, you know, he can make stuff really fun, but in like a very like an overly written kind of way, you know what I mean? Whereas like man just like he just loves seeing people doing their job. He talks, man, in the director's cut commentary on the disc, he talks about like he in this scene in particular that like he just loves watching people like calmly and succinctly like under pressure like doing their job. And like I just love a guy who just loves to watch people do their job and loves to like depict people like being really fucking good at their job. And like this is a scene that's just all people sitting around this table like talking, but it just has like such like a pulse to it.
Yeah, it's kind of a marvel because even the direction of the moments, and I'll sort of just take it back. It's like the camera is sort of locked up and anchored in one specific spot.
It's
we'll
a
just
Secret
talk
Service
over it.
Cutting, letter drop. We plan cutting to stake it out when he shows we'll grab anything from Chicago.
Unfolding here, and I'll just pause it. The plan unfolding in the way that the camera is locked off and coming between them. He's so smart because he almost intuitively knows how much exposition we need and what other details that we need and what are those things, and is then careful to go back to Will. Because for anyone who's listening to this podcast that's a bit of a psycho about this knows where this ends up, which is that they're not going to intervene. They want to let it run because they don't know what the code is and they don't know if they can break it. And there's a whole bunch of other perilous things they have to consider. But just the pace of bang, bang, they say on this one table, they introduce these other faces, and then he's already quick. But before we just stopped that previously, this is the first cut. It's bouncing back in between.
Goes to the other side of the table. What is Will think? Blonde hair found in the Jacobies. That note was.
And that moment of Farina looking, that last moment before the confirmation is
Gail counts and core size
is
of the
Farina
hair
as Jack Crawford looking at Will. Like,
yeah,
this is my plan, but I'm looking at Will because I want him to know, I want to see what his reaction to my proposed plan is. And it's not
that
exactly
note
what you
was
expect.
Written by your man.
God, good faces on all these background
it's
players too.
She
has an amazing face.
We're about to cut in a second to, you can see him in the frame that you have a puzzle on in the background blur Chris Elliott back there.
Yeah.
And we're about to like put him in there. Every time that I see Chris Elliott show up, I'm like, oh shit, right, Chris Elliott's in this fucking movie.
44 minutes, 54 seconds. You want to see his blurred face? Well, now we're going to rush to his clean and crisp face.
Aside from the hair, three blue green.
And Chris Elliott later, he's got a great face and he's been used primarily deployed as like the most ridiculous comedic actor as possible. But here, just a weird guy, just another bunch of weird folk.
Grange Dark Flex went to Brian's End.
The Grange's are commercial granulated cleanser with chlorine from the cleaning man. Several particles of dried blood, but not enough to type.
God, I love these inserts. So amazing.
I love how like white, like you and Dan and Connor talked a bit about kind of production design with the movie and everything, and like the color palette. I love how like white everything is here. I love like how we trace kind of the color of the production design throughout like the entire movie, because it starts like, you know, at the beach, like everything with the Grahams is very like very white, very like beachy, you know, sandy beige colors, and like even the opening scenes, like the Leeds family home is very white, very like very modern, very 80s. And then obviously Lecter's cell is like pristine white. And we got the whiteness here too. And I feel like after this, like, especially because Dolarhyde hasn't been introduced yet, like once Dolarhyde comes in, he's introduced almost immediately in complete darkness, like in the dark room and everything. And then his home is very dark. And like, what is like the one pronounced darkness here? Is Will Graham in a black button up, you know, amidst all
and
these
his green tie and all these other bright things, all these other beiges and taupes and weird shades of colors that are around it, but they're not, none of them are striking other than the, you know, the big erect American flag with the silver eagle in the corner. Of course, Dennis Farina has that there. Of course he does.
I love to in my colleague Mia Livaccino, who you and Katie had on Miami Nice, talking about so her interview with Michael Mann that she did for Letterboxd. He talks in that a little bit about how all of the FBI like buildings, the process labs, like that was the real, those were like the real buildings, the real process labs, and everything that he filmed in here, which just speaks so much to like how much Michael Mann cares about attention to detail and like research and just like getting the accuracy, that real feel of everything, which I think comes through a lot. And even in a scene like this, like it just feels like we're just watching like so many of these people, you know, you were talking about these great faces that they have, like so many of them just feel like these are just the real people, and they just threw in, you know, Peterson and Farina and Chris Elliott here and like had them interact with the real folks.
It's so great to think. It's so unbelievable to think about the impact of Miami Vice, the TV show, that in 1985, Michael Mann is just like, his production company calls the FBI field office and is like, I want to film a movie there. And they're like, sure, Michael Mann, come in. Just come shoot it. It's fine.
What's it about? A horrific serial killer? Great.
Cool. Show all of our, you know, state of the art crime solving techniques. And he's just there. It's also that thing that, you know, the great unanswered question of Mindhunter, which is like the third season, was, you know, Michael Mann making this movie and being a character in the next series. And it's like, yeah, because they're filming in the buildings. Mia is such a sweet pixie angel, by the way. I got to meet her when I was in LA. Yeah. She's the best. Absolute best. And that interview is terrific. She did amazing work. You guys can check that out on Letterboxd. It's amazing.
The Grange's are commercial granulated cleanser with chlorine from the cleaning man. Several particles of dried blood, but...
Don't you love there? You can see in the background, you can see Congress. You know, you can see Capitol Hill. It's really incredible. And if they're shooting in the real buildings, it's just such a miracle. You see all these white lights and these halogen lights, but and car parks in the background. I love that really ugly... what would you call it? It's kind of like... I don't know. It's like, it's kind of aggressive Washington architecture. Lots of hard angles, you know, and they're contrasted by these big, beautiful, stately reflections and representations of kind of American Republic, you know, as, you know, proto, you know, as a sort of neo-Rome power with all these other great architectural builds. But then around it, it's just a lot of these ugly square boxy buildings that are around. Yeah. You can see it even in the lighting and in the reflections.
Not enough to tell you.
It's great too, because it's like looking back, that it's like these are like halls of justice that are behind, yes, like the institutions that are supposed to keep us safe, and we're in this building specifically with these people who are right now failing to keep people safe. You know, they're trying to clean up the mess and they're not succeeding in doing it right now. So it's like this, all of these institutions that are supposed to make us feel nice and, you know, proper and safe and comfortable in our homes, they are not getting the job done.
And even when they're working round the clock, like it's nighttime.
Yeah.
How long have they been there? They've been there all night. These folks are working like however many countless hours to do this. And yeah, it's just like all of them are there tirelessly working, trying to come up with plans on the fly, but it's all very improvisational at this moment, that they're just trying to figure out what the next play is and deliberating it quickly and under pressure and having really clear, clean articulation of what they have to do next. So good. Love that insert, by the way.
Chester, who am I talking to?
Will Graham, Jack Crawford.
Got a personal ad with Avid Fan in it being telex to you right now.
Read it.
Dear Avid Fan, you honor me. You're very...
Oh, man.
Those eyes.
Look at that shot. Those eyes. William Peterson's eyes. Dear avid fan. Listen to that. We've got to go back. I'm sorry. We're going to do a bit of commentary track talking over here.
Grains are commercial granulated cleanser with chlorine.
Cameras staged around the table and moving. We're about to set up to this beautiful insert shot. It's 45 minutes and 5 seconds into the film.
Chester, who am I talking to?
We're looking down the line of the table.
Got a personal ad with avid fan in it being telex to you right now.
Read it.
Read it.
Avid fan.
Bang. As soon as he starts reading the note, we are in William Graham's corneas, basically. It's
Man talks so much about like that Peterson, you know, the gift of this performance. And I feel like Sean Cosby talked about this a lot on your episode with him earlier, yes, in the series, that like the gift of Peterson's performance that I think goes really undervalued is how much he's giving without kind of like vocalizing, like how much just this dude holds in his body and in his face. Like he is doing so much silent acting. So like here you see the second that you hear avid fan, like you can see the gears turning in him. Like he's woken up, like he's registering that. He's thinking like, what does that mean? How does that, you know, how does that lead me into the next thing? Where are those gears going to take me next?
45 minutes, 16 seconds. One of the shots of the movie for me. Dear avid fan, bang, he turns on. Unbelievable. Mm. Let's listen to the letter from the Tooth Fairy to Lecter.
You're very beautiful.
Oh, Christ.
I offer 100.
You're very beautiful. Brina. Christ. Oh, Chicago, man. What a town. What a town. What a fucking legend. Christ. You're beautiful. Christ. I love the chorus of all these people reacting differently.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Mm-hmm. This is a great little still 45 minutes, 20 seconds. It's just racking the focus differently along the line of people. And yeah, it's so good. And, you know, curiosity, you know, frustration, you know, disgust, awe. It's brilliant. It's such an amazing little chorus of faces that we're seeing in this scene too.
And it's our first time like being kind of woken up to like who Dollar Hyde is. You know, he hasn't been introduced to the movie yet. This is kind of our first understanding of like how this man communicates, which I think, you know, is so telling. And then we're seeing, like, we're processing how we're reacting to kind of hearing these words and hearing how he, you know, articulates himself at the same time that all of these people are getting that as well.
Prayers for your safety. Find help in Galatians 6:11, 15:2, Acts 3:3, Revelations 18:7, Jonah 6:8, John 6:22, Luke 1:7.
Thanks.
So great. Have to. Shout out incredible performances in this movie. One of them particularly, and I'm going to grab his name because I want to make sure that I get it right. Bill Smitrovich as Lloyd Bowman here, who's rapidly scribbling down these notes, and you can hear the scratching of his felt pen on the paper. It's so brilliant. He's got the green behind him, as we saw the boys earlier with the green, as he's processing this information and scribbling it down. And he's just so great. And this whole crew that is around the table are so capable and amazing that it's just like, oh, all of these people are so essential here. But I think his performance, he's had one of the lines of the movie, "You are so sly, but so am I." It's Sly Man himself. And he's just frantic. And Bill Smithovich, man alive, what a career. Like, I mean, you know, he's in kind of trashy movies like Air Force One, but he's had a career that's like literally all the way up to Joker, Voila Do. Like, he's just like, he's been in 2.5 Men. He was in Ted. He's in so many movies, but when you go all the way back, he started in about 1982. There's just a bunch of rippers. He's in Manhunter. He's in Crime Story. He's later on in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And then he's in a bunch of movies. He's in Independence Day, Ghosts of Mississippi. He's in a whole stack of stuff. If you've seen his face, you would just know him immediately. But I just love him. I always want to give him a shout out, Bill Smithovich, because he's just so good.
Surprises me too. He kind of looks like Michael Mann, which I find interesting.
He's
got
a touch of the man's about him. He's a bigger guy.
A bigger guy.
Michael Mann's a small guy.
Yeah.
Man and William Peterson, if William Peterson shaved at the time of this movie, but much closer together.
Yeah. All those heads turning so fast.
Oh, so good. What is he
doing?
I
love this bit because it's like, it just speaks to like how Graham can never sit still because he's about to ask, as Bowman's, you know, going through trying to figure out what these verses are, where they are, if they're Bible verses, whatever. Like, Graham immediately starts, like, he takes a second, like, while this guy's doing that, Graham's immediately, he's about to ask, like, if there's any leads on the prints from the Leeds house. And yes. It's like, he cannot sit still for a second. He's taking this, you know, 5-second break to ask if there's any advance on this other lead. Like, he knows that they are on a clock right now. Like, time is ticking. Not only the lunar cycles, you know, coming around, but right now, they got to make a decision about what they're doing with this letter, if they're running this letter or not. So he's not letting any second go to waste.
I think you're so right. And it's so funny because it's like that whole idea about putting a different note in now is like dead to him. So he his immediate reaction doesn't say it to Jack straight away, but him saying, "Are there leads on the print?" is basically he's sort of inferring that without having to say it outright. It's so spectacular. And I think this entire scene, why it is brilliant, is because it's exactly what you're talking about. The clockwork, the internal clockwork of having to solve this now is it's not doing it with a timer. It's not being clever. It's just like the way that everyone is communicating, the way that they're talking, it's so direct and assertive that it's like, we must get an answer to make this happen. Like, it's round the table. It's really spectacular.
We're all identifying them off the leads, Prince.
Not yet.
Cryptography at Langley.
They got shot at Telex.
Jack too. Cryptography.
Crawford, yeah, exactly. And they're just him and Graham are just so in sync. I love that too. That like we're just brought into that world with them from the beginning of the movie. And like Farina and Peterson do such a great job of making us buy that relationship and this history that these guys have together. They're just so natural together. I mean, all them and man, all these Chicago boys just kind of, you know, they've got this rhythm, they've got this background together.
Having the time of their lives, bless their heart. I do want to say something because I missed it in the episode. Guzmano Cesaretti had such an amazing influence over Michael Mann's work from his photography, is uncredited in the movie. He's in it. He's the National Tatler photographer.
Oh, shit.
What a man, little nugget there. He's now frantically, Lloyd Bowman is poring over a bunch of Bibles and things like that and law dictionaries that are just in the... You know, this is never in a contemporary boardroom, but like in a boardroom in the FBI, like there's books, there's things. It's a legal company, so there's things that they can refer to. Graham looking at the families. Oh, man. That is a great pan down, that just like 2-second scene. It skips over to Graham. It looks like he's got aspirin in front of his seat. He's got like a cup of coffee and he looks down and he picks up one of the files and he just looks in and sees the families of both victims. Like, again, just if you don't need any...
Reminding himself and reminding us.
If you don't need any further reinforcement, what this note is just enabling another beautiful, you know, picturesque family to be killed.
No. And our ad has to go out in the same book code Lecter used, or he'll know it wasn't Lecter talking to him.
Book code?
One on the prayers could be the page number, the parent numbers could be lying.
I love this shot here. The low framing looking up, and then this glass of water that's like right in the middle there. The idea of water in Mann's movies, right, is like so prominent as this like idea of like escape and freedom. Like so often we see like characters looking out towards the sea. I think Manhunter, you know, hits that, like we open up with them at the beach, right? And like that's kind of where Graham is. That's like he's at this sort of like this place of like freedom for him. And then so often water is representing freedom. Miami Vice, like Collateral, obviously. And here I just love this idea that like the water's there, but it's trapped in this glass, right? For Graham, it's like he's not even looking at it, but it's like that's where he needs to get back to, is the water, is the beach with his family. But he is, you know, he's locked in at this point. And we're about to see the decision that he's gonna make here. Like this scene is kind of the tipping point for him, where there's no turning back. Like he's putting himself full force. The thing that he said he was not gonna do, he's about to fucking do.
He keeps doing those things.
Letter, but what book?
Not the Bible?
No. Galatians 15:2. Galatians only has 6 chapters. The same with Jonah 6:8. Jonah only has 4 chapters. Just Lecter was not out. Using the Bible.
Talking it out.
And the Tooth Fairy probably named the book in the part Lecter tore out.
Right. What about Sweat and Lecter?
He tried sodium amytol on him 3 years ago to find where he buried a Princeton student. Gave him a recipe for potato chip dip.
Wonderful.
Such a great detail.
I love that. Trisodium amytol, which is truth serum for those playing at home, on him, and he gave him a recipe for potato chip dip a Princeton student he buried.
Cox is so good too at like playing that aspect of Lecter, of just being like a little fucking shit. Like that, the way that he captures that is so brilliant.
Oh, this might be one of my favorite shows I've ever done with little fucking shit. He really is.
That scene later, I mean, you'll get to it later, but the scene later where he calls Graham and he's laying in bed with his feet up against the wall like a high school girl talking to their boyfriend on the phone. Like it's masterful.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, we have to, let's play that out again. That's
book in the part Lecter tore out.
Right. What about Sweat and Lecter?
He tried sodium amytol on him 3 years ago to find where he buried a Princeton student. Gave him a recipe for potato chip dip.
Wonderful.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. Crawford again with the perfect, like, you know, bringing back the Christ, like just wonderful.
He's not even on the screen and he's the best.
You just hear him. You hear him chiming in.
The Tooth Fairy would have named a book he knew Lecter has access to.
He'd know it from articles he'd read about Lecter.
Willingham, when he tossed his cell, took Polaroids so they can get everything back in place.
Have him meet me with Lecter's pictures of Lecter's books.
Where?
I love that whip pan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 46 minutes, 56 seconds. There's a whip pan on Bowman as he's running out the door. Have him meet me with the books.
Library of Congress.
Minutes. He won't make it in time.
Lecter's ad runs as is. We decode it later, or we pull it, figure out the code, and run our own ad next week.
And lose a week? We got 17 days till the next.
And I don't like Lecter's ad running without knowing what it says.
This is the other side of this boardroom, which is looking to the White House now.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
I never noticed it. He's looking out there. Again, it's that same messaging, but it's like that whip of like, again, do we let it run? Do we let it run and we don't know what the code is? It's so...
Graham already knows what he's going to do, too. Like the second that Crawford brings up the options, Graham shuts down the idea of not running it.
No, he's like, we're running it. We're running it. We're not losing any more time. Because ultimately, Graham knows that the most likely thing is that he's at risk. And he's just like, yeah, sure, sure. Why not? Yeah, like,
and
why
he doesn't,
not?
I mean, you'll get to it later, but oof, he does not realize how at risk he is.
Oh, no.
Or not specifically him, but, you know.
Exactly.
It's crazy seeing him make these moves. Because that's the thing for Graham, too, is like, and the thing he tells his wife earlier on is like, I'm not going to let myself be front and center. And but for him, as he's going in this, he has such a tunnel vision that he doesn't care if he's front and center, but he's not thinking about, you know, Lecter is a guy who will go after your family. Like, he's just playing the game. He loves playing the game. And Graham, he just gets that narrow sight onto his target. And for him, it's all about him and the relationship with these killers. But he's not thinking about, you know, the family back at home and how easily they could get involved here.
It's so cool, like, just technically as well, in this moment of, like, it's 47 minutes, 19 seconds as we're looking at it. The framing of the steel chair makes it look like a fisheye lens, and it's not. Yeah. It's just a low angle 35. It's such a cool trick. Just framing the scene to perfection. Absolutely electric. And then you actually get the scale, or the three-dimensional print nature of these big, you know, light enclosures that are in this boardroom. It's so great. And like, one side you've got Capitol Hill, the other side the White House, and this thing right there, so you can tell that that's where it is, and they're using the set. It's so great. And I love almost they don't look at each other when they know they have to say something mm-hmm. the other doesn't want to hear. Mm-hmm. They just don't look at each other. They don't have to. It's like, I'm gonna say something that you're gonna be mad at, so I don't want that to happen.
It's your call, Will.
Run it.
And what if it encourages the Tooth Fairy to do something else beside right?
We'll all feel sick for a very long time.
And if Bauman still can't figure
line.
It out?
Oh, we'll all feel sick for a very long time.
God, let's watch it again.
It's your call, Will.
Run it.
And what if it encourages the Tooth Fairy to do something else beside right?
We'll all feel sick for a very long time.
And then immediate cut to the close-up of his face, too.
All feels sick for a very long time. Said from a person who's felt sick for a very long time. It's just like...
It's cool. Yeah. He's like, you guys don't even understand the world that I've been living in.
You don't understand what sick is. Oh, God. What a great scene. Holy. We're not even done yet, but my God.
Bauman still can't figure it out?
Then we'll bait him with something else in next week's Tatler.
What, for instance?
Me. I don't...
This is so good.
See, I feel like Graham, he knew, you know, 5-10 minutes ago that this is where it was going to lead. Like, he already had this plan in motion. The second that he dropped that info, he's like... The second he heard Avid Fan, he's probably like... We're going to use me as bait. That's it. Done.
Easy. No problem. And here Paul Perry plays Sidney Bloom, and he's just like, hey, I don't like this idea.
He's like, freaking out.
He needs a moment of intervention. We're going to see that. And it's so great in a moment, but it's just like, we're going to bait him with the Tatler. He's like,
I think that's a very good idea.
I don't think that's a very good idea.
He looks at him.
Oh, guys, Graham, I don't think it's that's a great idea.
It's the first moment in the entire scene that Dr. Sidney Bloom has said a word. He's just kind of listened very patiently. As you said, we're going around this table. We've got Zella, played by Chris Elliott. We've got all these people that are just going around, you know, outlining all these different things. And now, I don't think that's a very good idea.
It's your call, Will.
Run it.
And what if it encourages the Tooth Fairy to do something else beside right?
We'll all feel sick for a very long time.
And if Bauman still can't figure it out?
Then we'll bait him with something else in next week's Tatler.
What, for instance?
Me. I don't think that's a very good idea.
Don't you love that cut from Bloom to Will at 47 minutes, 53, it just cuts into his open, vicious mouth.
Yeah.
It's like you are putting yourself in the snare. It's like those crazy folk that we see online who put their heads in, you know, under in crocodiles and stuff like that. And I'm just like, cool, you are just begging for the worst, most catastrophic accident to happen.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, he's fully knowingly throwing himself right into the thrust of it.
Oh, God. And then this beautiful zoom out of all of the different particulars, the study of his handwriting, the Tooth Fairy's handwriting, all this sort of stuff as we come out. Why not?
Provoke him?
Maybe he can be provoked. What I was thinking about is you. You're getting deeper and deeper into this. Sydney?
I love this as well because it's like Sydney has a moment to command this scene, and also, man, just like the smartness of like, how do I make it feel like these people are all collegial and they work together or whatever? It's like actually interrupting the scene, pausing. Okay, we're going to reconvene. Sydney and Will start talking. Why do you think it's a bad idea? Because he respects him, shows that Will respects him. And then just people saying goodbye. Hey, Will. Yeah. Hey, Sydney. Talk to you soon.
It's like for these people, it's just like the end of the meeting. Like they're going home.
Yeah, we're just leaving. We're just going home tonight. Thanks for calling us in, Jack. We've done our best. Yeah, there's nothing else. And Will's like, I'm gonna be bait in the mouth of this demon.
Well, good luck with that. We'll see you later.
See you, Will. Nice to see you, Sydney. Golf next Saturday. Love this. And yeah, the Will Graham, William Peterson hand on the wall here is there as they're just sort of reconvening over all of this evidence, all these printouts of all this evidence.
Last time you
the man
did
knows
it,
how to have a stance.
Oh, man. And just, again, the framing, each of them in the foreground, in the foreground of each of the frames, also like tilted to the side and the back and forth, the two shot. It's just orchestrated to perfection.
Job of pushing yourself all out of shape. You try it on again or you go through some big trauma, you could relapse, my friend.
Sydney, don't worry about me. I'm working the evidence, making moves. That's all.
I love that line. I'm working the evidence, making moves. That's all. My boy is in denial.
And what, you know, much could be said about myself and Will Graham in this. Sweetheart, I promise I'm not doing another podcast. I'm just, you know, working the evidence, making moves.
Just making moves. That's all. I love that, like, everybody, even the beginning scene of the movie, like Crawford coming to Will and like asking him to get back into this, like he knows what this is going to do to him. Like everybody around Will who's experienced this before knows what it's going to do to him, knows that when he gets involved, like he can't not go all the way. And
he doesn't
like,
have
how
an off
much
switch.
It's torn him apart. Exactly.
There's no off switch.
But it's like, it's that thing of like, you care about this guy, but you also know like he's the only one who can get this job done. So you not only have that kind of duality for Will of having to get involved with this place that he should never go again. You also have the people around him like Crawford who are willingly like inviting him to do this, knowing what's going to happen and the kind of like guilt that they have to live with that, even though, you know, Sydney's pushing, telling him not to, but like, what do you think he's going to do, bro? Like,
yeah,
you know, this guy.
And they're all exceptional. That's the other thing. Cause we've just seen over and over, all the people in that room are exceptional. And so Will has something different. He's got something spiritual. That's not it. He's working the evidence. He's making moves. He's making decisions. He's trying to implore Sydney to the science. Like, I'm sticking with the science. I'm looking at the evidence. I'm making moves. I'm making value judgments to make this happen. But it's not that. It's not that.
Yeah. It's anybody who's good at their job could work the evidence.
Anyone in that room can. And so again, it's just this other empty thing, but he knows and they all know.
He knows. Yeah. Cause that's what he says to his wife at the beginning when she's like, you know, they've got a million people who can do this. And he's like, not like me.
And he's right. That's what's so bad. That's the quandary. He's right. He's the best.
Yeah.
And he's done the same thing. He's done the same thing. He was like, no, get our guy to do the prints.
Yeah.
He's not as good. He's the best.
He not only knows that he's good, he knows the other people that are good. He knows the other people that are the ones that need to do this shit.
Yeah. And he knows Bloom's good too.
Yeah.
Bauman just struck up. It is not books in Lecter's cell.
Rice?
He just heard it's a bust out. As evidence, the Leeds print will get us a conviction if we could ever find the guy. But he must never have been printed because he is not in our index. We are not going to identify him off the print.
I'll use Lowndes.
What for?
Boy doesn't read the New York Times literary.
Crawford terrified.
He reads Lowndes, not Tyler.
What for? What are we using lounge for?
Terrified by it.
I'm just saying.
He can't even like process like what we could possibly use Freddie Lounge for.
Yeah, he's like, what for? But I love here we're getting all those bits. It's like Will's already looking at the print. Jack's already looking at the blood. Like, do we have him? No, don't have this. Hair, fiber, no, not in an index. He is off the map. He's off the reservation. We have to catch him in the act. We need more time. We need more evidence. We're not going to do it. And this is a great little like,
you're not going to.
Having this scene and having for basically most of this like final moments, Jack, you know, where I've just paused it for Mitch and I at 48:30. Jack has been in the background talking for the entire scene behind Will, blurred. And he walks back and sort of imposes himself in the last 30 seconds of the scene that we're talking about here and sort of outlines it. But man, so intuitively gets that here in this moment where he says, I don't think that's a good idea. It brings it back to the reality of Will in this situation, which is so great. And then when he comes back, we're ready for more exposition because we've had that.
It is not books in Lecter's cell.
Rice?
He just heard it's a bust out.
Love that Will as evidence picks up a cigarette too after this meeting's over.
He's just smoking inside in the corner. It's fine. God, I miss smoking in buildings. It's was a time.
Just a conviction if we could ever find a guy. But he must never have been printed because he is not in our index. We are not going to identify him off the print.
I love that raised eyebrow from Bloom. 48 seconds, 48 minutes, 47 seconds. He just looks at Will like, now what? Now what?
Will raises one back.
I use Lounge. What for?
I think that Jack must think that Will's like, I'll bait them to kill Lance, which is true. That like,
honestly, it would have been a better, yeah. Well,
it's going to happen later. Like, he's like, what for? I'm going to bait him.
Boy doesn't read the New York Times Literary Supplement. He reads Lounge and the Tattler.
Thomas so Harris is sick for coming up with the Tattler, too. What a great name for a gossip rag.
Every name in this movie is brilliant. Dr. Sidney Bloom, Jack Crawford, yeah. Will Graham, Hannibal Lecter, Francis Dolarhyde.
Francis Dolarhyde is crazy.
Crazy. Crazy.
Like, if you're born with the name Francis Dolarhyde, like, you have to be a serial killer. I'm sorry.
I'm so
you're not working
sorry.
At the bank named Francis Dolarhyde.
You call your local bank. Hello, this is Francis Dolarhyde speaking. You're like, no,
absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
Why
do people keep hanging
you.
Up on you, Francis? I don't know. Weird. Absolutely not. But I do love this last moment. This is just before it pivots to the next scene where the last punctuation gesture is that gaping
back on the teeth, yeah.
Teeth print. We are back in his teeth. We're about to be in his snare. We don't know how close we're going to be, but here it is. And then to cut to Lowndes. Oh, wow.
That's good shit.
This movie rules, Mitchell Beaupre. It absolutely
rules. We
should do
a podcast about this movie. That's fucking thing.
Wait, we weren't recording? It's just you and I. Just
watch
it.
Just
watch
it. Just watching scenes.
I would not put it past me. When I eventually have some kind of dementia symptom later in life, it will be.
You're just doing this.
I'm just doing this and it's not recording anymore. I'm just talking to no one. Look at this. Look at this guy.
Look at this scene in Heat 2. This thing is sick.
Oh, man, alive. I'll still be sharp for that. That's in a couple of years.
Yeah. Well,
that's coming. It's coming
We're
in
cooking.
Thick and fast. We're cooking.
We've
got to announce by the end of the year, surely, Mitchell. I mean, we've got to announce who this cast is. End of the year.
Come on, Michael. They should have launched it with the archives. With the archives launch. Also, here's the cast of Heat 2. Exclusively on the archives, you can check out the cast of Heat 2.
Holy.
Behind the paywall.
Holy.
That's free ideas, Michael Mann. That's free ideas right there.
Listen, there's been a few podcasts about Michael Mann that I know of that would have also loved that news to be exclusive. Would have loved that. Call us. Mitchell Beaupre, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. This is always so fun talking to you. Thank you so much for being a part of Min Hunter. Your brilliant insights are always so cherished and and your insults to Hannibal Lecter and Brian Cox are the highest shelf.
My admiration, for capturing that spirit. We all could have that sort of whimsical nature to us if we weren't so jaded and cynical.
If only we could lie on sodium amytal and give potato chip dip recipes when people are trying to find the Princeton student we buried. Man alive, what a great scene. What a great scene.
Thanks for having me for it, bro.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime. You know that. Please share with any of the listeners where they can find some of your great stuff. This episode, so far in my schedule of when it is going to be arriving, just so that I can help you, will be around early November. So is there any early November, in about 4 weeks from now, any stuff that you guys have got coming up that you can share?
Yeah, definitely. I think by then, so I mean, if you want to check out just anything Letterboxd is doing, Letterboxd Journal is kind of where all of our editorial stuff runs. Really great interviews there, other features on all kinds of movies, older, newer, what have you. Our YouTube is really kicking off. You can find the Mia's whole interview with Michael Mann that we mentioned. That's in print. That's also in video form with Mann going deep on some of his favorite movies as well as some of his own. By the time this drops, I'll have an interview on YouTube and Journal with Anna Kendrick for her directed movie Woman of the Hour, which I'm really excited for. I'm recording that next week at the time that we're recording this, so
right.
I'm very stoked for that to come out if you want to check that out.
Oh, definitely will. And yes, I confessed this to Mia when I saw her in person as well as recording our show. I was like, your interview with Mann was so good that I had to first watch it, the whole thing, and then the next watch it with notes and subtitles and pause lots of pauses to take it down. It's just primo stuff. Letterboxd Journal's killer. We'll tag all of your stuff in the post. But man, just thank you so much again for being a part of this. You're the best. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, man. Talking with you about Mann especially, it's an honor and a privilege.
Oh, well, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. And he's that Michael Mann, he can make a movie.
He's not a bad director. I don't know if that's a hot take or whatever, but honestly, not a terrible director.
Not, no. Like, actually, can direct the living shit out of a movie. Can Michael Mann. You're the best. Appreciate you. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of Mindhunter. This has been an episode of Mindhunter, the latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I, and all modern Mann movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there, and the Jimmy Kahn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon / One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron for as little as a dollar a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Mindhunter episode, Mindhunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.
Listen, everyone makes messes. It's just a part of life. And the bigger you live, the bigger the mess, if you know what I mean. That's why you need Fabuloso. With twice the active cleaning ingredients, it just completely takes the drama out of any mess. It smells great while you clean. The only way to describe it is the scent of passion. And once you're done cleaning, it lasts so long. You know, if you make a mess,
you can get your home dramatically clean with Fabuloso. No worries.